Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of Big Mouth. I'm Andrew Harrison, I'm back from my holidays, and I'd like to thank Michael Hann for holding the fort while I was away with two excellent shows. Unfortunately, contrary to Michael's reports, I have not come back with a Ron Mail moustache, nor a Martin Fry gold bacon foil suit, but a man must have ambitions, must he not? This week on the show, we're going to be looking at Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams, a co-production between Channel 4 and Amazon Studios. It adapts several of the prolific sci-fi author's short stories into standalone episodes. Does Dick's paranoid psychedelic worldview translate onto the small screen, and how does Electric Dreams compare with contemporary sci-fi TV like Westworld and The Handmaid's Tale? We'll also be looking at the new fifth album by monochromatic East London goths The Horrors, the imaginatively entitled V. How's their transition from junior Lord Sutches to cosmic explorers going? And we will be maintaining a fear-sodden mood with a look at Darren Aronofsky's controversial new horror movie, Mother, starring Jennifer Lawrence and Javier Bardem. What's going on in that spooky old house, and is it really the worst movie of the 21st century so far? With me to explore these and other matters, I have two special guests. Sean Pattenden is an erstwhile pop writer and graduate of the smash hit school of poptastic music criticism. She's also a writer of children's books and curator of the excellent North London art emporium, Grrr, where she sells things like sculptures by Terry Hall and Throbbing Gristle, 20 Golden Greats coffee mugs. Hello, Stan Pattenden. How are you today?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm not bad. It's a bit of a goth show this week, and I believe you've been writing about death lately.
I have been writing about death. I have a friend who actually worked on Death Row.
Mate was Suge Knight.
Yeah, Death Row. She was a lawyer and lived in New Orleans and went to Louisiana State Penitentiary to speak to the people and try and get them not dead.
Right.
I mean, that is one of the most hardcore jobs I've ever heard of, so I really, really wanted to speak to her, so I've written
about it. It's not interviewing, Big Fun, is it? It's not talking to the S Club.
No, it's Rachel Stevens was not in sight.
Where is this going to be appearing, this people?
This is appearing in a website which is about death called Passing Boxes, where the editorial is pin sharp.
On that cheery note, let's also introduce our other guest, the film and TV writer Ali Catterall.
Hello.
Hello. He's written for Film 4, Time Out, The Word and Q, and he now does the TV previews and reviews for The Guardian, where he attempts to sneak political commentary into previews of what's on E4 tonight. How are you, Ali? You all right?
I'm very well, thanks.
Keeping the good ship Big Mouth afloat, even when I deserted it. It's our producer, the Captain Ahab of podcast, Matt Hall. How did it go while I was away, Matt?
It was fine, but it wasn't the same, Andrew.
I think it was actually better. I feel like a fifth wheel. It was very funny, and it went great. But you know what happened in Blake 7 when they got rid of Blake? They all died. So remember that, you know.
Thanks.
Okay, so a quick reminder before we get started on the show. Valued listeners, if you use an Apple device, why not subscribe to Big Mouth on the Podcasts app or in the iTunes Music Store? And while you're there, you could give us a lovely review and a star rating as well if you have a moment. If you've got the new iPhone X, of course, you can probably leave a review by smiling at the screen or giving some sort of quizzical expression. Well worth a grand of your money, I'm sure. And Android people, remember, you can get us on Stitcher and Audio Boom and Spotify and pretty much everything else as well. Anyway, let's start with the meaty stuff. Mother. Can you hear me, Mother? Darren Aronofsky's latest movie, a sort of haunted house horror thriller, starring Jennifer Lawrence and Javier Bardem. It is the dictionary definition of divides the critics, in that it is dividing the critics from the audiences. The former are garlanding it with 5-star reviews, while Jamal and Josephine Public are hammering it with 1-star grade F ratings and pronouncing it the worst film of the 21st century so far. Who is right? What is this film trying to achieve, and should it be trying to achieve it? Let's have a taster.
We spend all our time here. I want to make a paradise.
She redid all of it. Every last detail. And she breathed life back into every room.
Are you happy?
I love you.
Please, come in.
Hello.
Hello. He's a stranger. We're just going to let him sleep in our house. Hello.
Hello.
Did you know he had a wife? What do they want? God help you.
They've come here to see me.
Come quick! You're insane! You're insane!
All I'm trying to do is bring life into this house! Open the door to new people, new ideas!
I'm so sorry.
Get out of my house! Get out!
You give and you give and you give.
It's just never enough.
Oh, Smother Me Mother, the trailer for Darren Aronofsky's Mother there. Now, before we get into this interesting piece of cinema, Ali Kattel, set it up for us. What is going on?
So, in Mother, you have Jennifer Lawrence, who's married to Javier Bardem, and she's much younger than he is, by the way, a bit like the director and Jennifer Lawrence. A bit Freudian there. So they're living together in this kind of creepy, sort of southern, looks like a southern Gothic mansion, which is far too big for any of them, in some isolated woodland, and strangers start to arrive. First of all, in the shape of Ed Harris, and then his wife, Michelle Pfeiffer, and then their sons, and then things just go mental and spiral completely out of control.
Apparently, for no immediately discernible reason, because the first half of the movie, what I scribbled on my hand was, it's the living, etc., Eraserhead, or the grand design, Sapphire and Steel. There's a lot of interior work going on here surrounding, but the walls are bleeding and the bath is vomiting up what appears to be human meat, or the toilet is rather, that kind of thing. And then in the second half, it seems to completely unhinge itself from any rationale or any kind of narrative at all.
It actually reminded me more of a kind of Cleese and Chapman Monty Python sketch when a series of terrible people start coming through the door, you know. Or maybe even like a Brian Ricks farce, you know, like, whoops, where's me baby?
I think you're right there, but I think you actually need to go further back. It actually reminded me of the Cat in the Hat, when things just start appearing in a house and more madness starts going on, and thing one and thing two arrive, and all of a sudden there's the baths are overflowing, and, you know.
Did you enjoy it?
I loved it, while also thinking it was completely hollow, like a kind of black hollow egg with nothing inside. But I loved it. I saw it at 11 o'clock in Wood Green View, other cinemas are available, and that's just no time to watch a film, quite honestly, and I loved it even then.
Good Lord. Sean Patton, what did you make of Mother?
I really enjoyed it too, and I thought it did take things to a logical conclusion. I don't think you can say that the later scenes, which we can't spoil for anyone, are anything but an extension of what happens at the beginning. I think the turmoil and chaos is what you want to happen. You want these people just to have the most extreme experience ever. But there is a point in the middle where you're just thinking, you could walk out the door, Jennifer Lord, you could just go. Things are a bit funny if it's me. I'd just say I'm popping to the shops. Leave them to it. There's, you know, bad things are afoot.
It's America. There's a motel somewhere down the road.
Well, this is it, because it's far from clear, as the movie develops, it's far from clear that we're really in America, or indeed the real world at all. And as somebody who's spent his life watching genre nonsense, I'm sitting there trying to parse it, going, is it all taking place within Javier Bardem's mind? Is it all taking place within Jennifer Lawrence's mind?
I don't think...
Is the house, the mind of Jennifer Lawrence? And thing is heavily allegorical.
And if I read up a little bit about it afterwards, and it's a bit parable overload. Yeah. And I was thinking there are too many levels to what underneath, as you're saying, there's nothing in the egg. There's actually sort of nothing there, but there's lots and lots of layers to what it could be.
It's very bejeweled, but there's nothing in it.
I was really not looking forward to this. I had this down as one of the kind of types of film that I avoid at any occasion. But actually, thinking, no, I've got to do it, and going and sitting in a kind of 1:30 screening, which was nearly as weird a time to go and see it, I've really enjoyed it, because it's just so silly.
It's so mental.
Because if you just park your kind of idea about a sensible story, or even really kind of caring what happens to any of the characters, just the way that everything is stacked up on a tiny... It's like someone's put a needle in the ground and then is building a upside-down pyramid right on the head
nonsense.
Of this needle. Of nonsense.
Yeah, it's not literal.
But if you can't do that in film, when you've got all these things that you're... You know, you've got loads of stuff that enable you to do that, why not do it?
I got to say, I hated this movie so much. I hated the last movie I hated as much as this was Synecdoche in New York, which is a similar movie, which Charlie Kaufman's movie, in which he uses the architecture of fantasy cinema to act out his sadism against his own characters. And I thought Aronofsky was acting out his sadism against, particularly the Jennifer Lawrence character.
I would say, he's more of a Lars von Trier pretender. Yeah. You know, when you see a Lars von Trier, those are the ones I have to walk out on, because he is so horrible to the leads, usually the female leads. You can see him sort of needling Jennifer Lawrence, but obviously there was a little romance going on in there.
It's quite an unhealthy obsession with the back of her neck.
There's a lot of the back of her neck, and there's a lot of her beautiful cheekbones, and she just looks so beautiful.
She is the paragon of cinema beauty at the moment, and I kind of think, if you're going to make a film in which 50% of the movie involves her being brutalised, close up in detail and relentlessly, and not to spoil it, but there's no happy ending in this film.
That makes it sound like it's kind of like a physical And it's kind of not really.
It is physical and psychological.
It's not much physical.
Not much physical.
Did you watch the final 10 minutes?
Yeah, okay, the final 10 minutes. But if you took that out, most of it's kind of mental.
You can't take that out because that is the logical.
No, I know. But what I'm saying, yeah,
she drinks poison at the beginning. That's pretty physical.
Well, I mean, to me, this is. We think basically a kind of an upmarket cahiers de cinema snuff movie in which you see a Hollywood star torn to pieces and
brutalised.
But that's
Lars von Trier idea, isn't it?
And I find it repulsive. I think, you know, we're in a world now where you can drop the avant-garde card on the table and it justifies everything.
I did think it was an art house film that had suddenly got a load of money behind it and, oh, OK, we can get Jennifer Lawrence. Well, it went more along the art house
I mean, I have to say, I know we've talked about Jennifer Lawrence, but, you know, the fact is that all of the kind of four, possibly six characters in the first half of the movie are just fantastic to look at in different
Michelle
ways.
Michelle Pfeiffer's amazing. And
Harris is just turning into a kind of walking skull. I mean, he's just his flesh has just disappeared from his head, and it's just amazing.
Well, that's one of the things I found doubly infuriating about this film, which is that the performances are great, the technical filmmaking is amazing, the structuring is fantastic, and it's all put in the service of this hateful, nihilistic, brutalizing thing. I mean, it's clearly an allegory for creation in many ways, and you can take it as a straightforward biblical allegory if you want to. When the Ed Harris and the Michelle Pfeiffer characters stop flooding into the house, they are they're so trite and soapy in their behaviour that I started to think, oh, this is clearly the ideas in Javier Bardem, the poet's mind, are manifesting as reality with his with his trite stock characters and their naff kind of daytime drama motivations. But then the thing develops further and further, and you start to think you lose your bearings entirely. And I have no idea what he's trying to say, but I really wish he would stop saying it.
Isn't there a lot about kind of social media and about the role of the artist and about fame and what it does to people and what it does to audiences and their expectations? I loved all that, and I think that was a really kind of exciting way to kind of think about those things.
And it's also saying the myth of the creator is a myth. And they're actually an arsehole. And, egotistical maniac that ruins people's lives.
There's a moral extension to himself.
Yes, I think so.
There's a line from The Singing Detective, the original, in which Marlowe is, and Michael Gambon, who stands in for Dennis Potter in very many ways, is talking with a shrink, and he says, "You don't understand writers. You know, they'll use anything and anyone. They'll eat their own young."
Yeah.
And that really that quote really occurred to me while watching this.
That's the Sliver of Glass as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Graham Greene is, you'll just sell everyone down the river.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is all true, but what I find it almost more infuriating that, you know, this is not just honest trash. This is not just an honest, bloody torture movie. This is trash that thinks it's got something to say to the world.
I'm not sure. I mean, I've heard it described as a kind of Rorschach map of,
they can read anything into it that you wish.
Yeah, basically. I think it's just an immense put-on. I think it's a fantastic, endless shaggy dog story.
But that's another reason to hate it. I don't want to be wound up by this.
But how can you hate something that has so little substance? You know, I mean, for me, it just
that's
looks...
That's why I hated it. I mean, Pete Bradshaw in The Guardian, very interesting piece this week. Pete Bradshaw thinks it's a crazily brilliant and audacious movie. And he declares that the audiences simply don't get the surrealism, horror, arthouse provocation and deadpan black comedy. Very short on laughs.
See, I laughed loads at it.
Yeah,
What made you
laugh?
There were bits where that were just hilarious. The bit with the toad... was like, what was the point of
just
that?
The bit where
scenes just started to become totally ridiculous. You know, the bits in the second half of the film, which I won't talk about, but which pile ridiculousness upon ridiculousness to see how far it'll go before it all collapses in on itself.
There was one point where she had a baby very, very easily. And it was the one scene where you could have actually been realistic and talked about how gory it is and shown how difficult it is. But it just pops out.
Yeah, no difficulty whatsoever in showing sheer physical brutality towards Jennifer Lawrence. But do we want to see a vagina on the screen? Oh, God, no. You know, that kind of thing. Really squeamish in lots of ways.
Well, you do kind of, but it's...
Can I just read some of the credits? Because they are amazing and sort of sum up the film. The character credits include... Cupbearer, bumbler, defiler, pisser, plunderer, pilferer, neophyte, initiate, fornicator, whoremonger. You don't get that many of those. Slave driver, devourer, and underling.
Is there space for podcaster there? Because I would like to be in this as podcaster.
And also, the main characters have no names. Yeah. And I did think that was quite clever. But there's points where she's obviously, there's a point where he's in the background. Jennifer Lawrence is trying to call him. She's not allowed to say his name because he doesn't have one. She's like, hello.
I mean, you all enjoyed it. I found it utterly infuriating. I think, you know, beautifully drawn vicious cruelty is still vicious cruelty.
I'm actually thinking of going to see it again.
Okay, well, I'm thinking of going to see something else to cancel out from you going to see this film. I'm with Rex Reed in the New York Observer. He said, this delusional freak show is 2 hours of pretentious twaddle. Succinct.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
I would too.
What do you want to go and see? 2 hours of pretentious twaddle.
It's great fun,
I can't believe that I'm the one defending pretentious twaddle on this programme when your whole...
You know, here's my issue with it, right? The premise and the particularly the resolution and the alleged twist at the end of this movie would disgrace a 2000 AD future shock. It would disgrace a mid-80s Doctor Who.
But
it's like, that's your revelation. That's your revelation.
Well, you know, I don't.
Can I just moan about cinemas for a moment? I didn't quite get the twist at the end because at the beginning of the film, I had to go out of the cinema into the main bit where they sell popcorn and say, please, can you turn the house lights off? Which they do every time at my local cinema. I just keep the house lights on so you can't see the film.
Name
properly.
And shame.
View Finchley Road.
Sorted out, View Finchley Road.
Yeah, so I missed the beginning bit because I'd spent 5 minutes trying to find the manager to get the house lights turned down.
Well, I was going to ask you all, is this the worst movie of the 21st century so far? Clearly, you lot don't think it is. I don't think it is either because certainly it's not Battleship. You know, it's not based on a board game. That is the worst film of the 21st century or indeed any century so far. My advice to listeners would be do not under any circumstances go and see Mother, but clearly...
My advice is go and see it.
Yeah. Run to the cinema, rush there.
But hey, not with your mother.
No, definitely.
Or a small child.
Yeah, or indeed anybody else's mother. And if you're a mother yourself, don't
mother.
Go either.
Can we keep saying mother, though?
Mother, well. amazing link there, Sean, because Mother, we're going to move on to Morrissey and cleanse the palate with a bit of music. Morrissey has a new single out from the forthcoming album Low in High School. It's out in November. The song is called Spent the Day in Bed. Is it any good, and who is he offending this time? Let's have a listen.
Spent the day in bed. Very happy I did. Yes, I spent the day in bed. No train, no bus, no bus, no rain, no train, no bus, no bus.
Morrissey with Spent the Day in Bed. Now, I've got two words for you there. Frasier chorus. Dream Kitchen. It is absolutely in that tradition. What did we make of this?
I'm really annoyed because I thought no one's going to get this, and I wrote down Frasier Chorus with the horrors.
There you go. So it's Frasier Chorus week on Big Mouth. Sean Patton, and what did you make of Morrissey Spent the Day in Bed?
I was expecting to hate this record, and I really liked it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because Morrissey doesn't do himself a great service, does he, at the moment, media-wise. And so you just think, well, this is going to be a load of absolute wallowing misery of how he doesn't like certain sort of sections of the community and how he's the best person ever in the world. But it's just about staying in bed and not going to work. And it's also ascribing a certain amount of self-care. You know, have
don't
a bath, look after yourself. Don't read the papers. Have a nice warm pudding. You know, maybe a little hot cocoa. And
with no milk.
It's incredibly chaste.
Yes.
I mean, he says, I am now laid. In one of his lyrics, but actually, he also says he doesn't fancy himself, so it's not a sex thing. He just wants to sit in bed. And I thought, well,
it's kind of a pop single equivalent of you know, have a duvet day, babes. You totally deserve it. XOXO,
like
lol.
Boots advert. Yeah,
you okay, hon? Ali, what did you think of this?
I really liked it. It's weird. There's kind of a disconnect now between his more kind of outre statements and his now incredibly quite bland lyrics. I mean, who doesn't want to stay in bed? I do. I agree. You know, there's nothing contentious about that. It's a chirpy, lovely, jaunty little tune. I can imagine the woman from the Trevago ad dancing.
Well, he's been accused ever since the Smiths dissolved of not changing the template and simply going on with an ever-degenerating version of the Smiths, you know, guitar, drum and bass player format. Not entirely true, because he's thrown in on the mariachi bands and stuff like that. But this is, for me, this is the biggest departure that he's made from the Morrissey template. And I think it's great fun. However, I wasn't aware, in the lyrics, I wasn't aware that workplaces actually enact castration, as he accused them of. I think that's a human resources issue there, isn't it? He's moaning about the news media again. He's gone totally canary. The album titles have been released. The song titles on the album have been released, and they are as good value as ever. When you open your legs, who will protect us from the police? home is a question.
Is that one song title?
It's a cover of a track off Crass's Freeding of the 5000, yeah. I think.
And interestingly, a couple of songs, The Girl from Tel Aviv Who Wouldn't Kneel, and Israel. So Morris is clearly getting on board with Israel. Beware of think pieces.
Or the Susan the Banshees track.
Well, I'm kind of hoping it is a cover of that.
I just say that I was really intrigued by the way that the record company has managed to orchestrate this launch. They had the show, the Chris Evans show on Radio 2, which is the biggest pop show on British radio, played it as a world exclusive at 8:10, which is the biggest slot on the biggest show on the BBC radio. And I kind of thought that was interesting because, you know, he hasn't troubled the Radio 2 playlist for a very long time, and how BMG managed to get that record played and that kind of focus on the single, I thought was quite an interesting matter. And he's doing a live thing for Six Music. They played it as an exclusive on Six Music as well at the same time. There's a lot of buzz around this record, and Morris's usual fallback on his last kind of few records when they've been released and immediate fallout with the record label is that they haven't understood him and they haven't actually done the work necessary to get him to his adoring audience. He's not going to have this excuse this time around.
Yeah. Let's have a bit more music. Let's move on. As usual, we ask our guests to bring in a tune that they're enjoying themselves right now, their own personal editor's recommendation. Sean Pattenden, what have you brought for us?
I've bought a band called Witch, which stands for We Intend to Cause Havoc, which is just the best thing ever. Sadly, they're not contemporary, so I'm being a fussy old bore. But they're a Zambian band, part of Zamrock, and there's a compilation you can get of four LPs from 72 to 77 out now. It's been out for a few years, but they are amazing. And this is dystopian Big Mouth. I'm calling us Dark Mouth this week. It's all gone terribly, terribly wrong. They are just a chirpy ray of psych rock Zambian sunshine.
Okay.
And listen to this and just be happy.
Well, you're going home in a crispy Zambian. This is Witch with Like a Chicken. Like a Chicken, as chosen by Sean Pattenden. Where does the Like a Chicken element come in?
It's just Like a Chicken. It's like, pretty
like
cool,
a chicken.
Probably.
What would Morrissey say?
Morrissey.
Isn't it I'd Like a Chicken?
No, you're acting like a chicken.
Right. A chicken.
Hey, sure, it's like funky.
Really, I could really do a chicken.
I think it's the feeling the funkiest you can. You're leaving the chicken alone. You're not going to eat them. You're going to dance with
the
chicken.
You feel like chicken tonight.
Okay,
we're going to stick with music and horror, or the slightly better kind of horror, with the fifth album by The Horrors. Since their arrival in the mid-noughties, Faris Badwin's band of rail-thin Edwardian rakes have rattled through their record collection for each album, from garage rock nightmares through slick grey walls of noise to cosmic dreamscapes. The music has often been great, but seldom focused. Does V fix that? Let's have a listen. From the new album, this is Something to Remember Me By. That was The Horrors and Something to Remember Me By. That's practically the Human League. That's not goth at all.
Do you not think it's totally the Psychedelic Furs?
It's a little bit the Psychedelic Furs.
With a load of effects right up to 11.
What do you make of The Horrors, Sian?
I'm not sure about The Horrors. I'm not sure. I want to like them. As you say, they're tall, they're thin, they're gothy. I mean,
they
what's
look
wrong
great.
With that?
If the hits were still going, they would have been in the smash hits, wouldn't they?
Oh, yeah.
The headline would have been Spook. It's The Horrors.
Yes, and he would have had a pineapple in his head. Faris Badwin. And they keep going, obviously. You know, this album after album, I couldn't say what album was what. I can't really differentiate many of their songs apart because it's a load of effects, bit gothy, slightly anthemic. And I think they're going for the Anthem Stadium stuff with this album. But I'm just not sure.
Well, they sort of did this path from like vaguely NME, North London scene band and being a visual surprise, shall we say, to make it, to sort of going properly serious and making records with Jeff Barrow from Portishead. And for me, they actually do the thing that everybody thinks My Bloody Valentine do better in many respects. Well, I'm not sold on My Bloody Valentine. I've never found them that interesting, and I'd much rather listen to The Horrors. Ali, what did you think of The Horrors, and particularly this album?
Well, I mean, speaking as a semi-retired goth myself, as
he's wearing a black t-shirt.
Collection of vast black t-shirts. It sort of reminds me of my youth going down to the Full Tilt in the Electric Ballroom in Camden and skating around to whatever Al Jorgensen was screaming about that week. Yeah, it was all right. I mean, for me, I quite like the fact they're quite earnest, actually. And that sort of puts me in mind a bit of... and musically, they sound a little bit at times, even like sort of Future Islands, you know, rather than kind of art techie rockers like, say, James Murphy. And so that immediately transports back again, sort of like watching Top of the Pops and watching these tall eldritch figures kind of bent over dry ice and keyboards. Yeah. It's all right, yeah. I mean, you can hear so many influences, or at least I can. You know, obviously, there's a huge dollop of Newman in there, and you can hear Depeche Mode at times, and I can even hear sort of like people like sort of Steve Mason at times, you know, stuff like that. The one thing I will caution them about is their lyrics. When I did hear one lyric, it was about a jewel and the crown, and it immediately put me in mind of Geraldine James. So I thought, you know, millennials, take care with your references.
I think they're quite posh, though. Actually, they're from jolly nice backgrounds, and I think that might account for that. I really loved this record. I agree with you. It's refreshing to have a band that takes things very, very seriously. It's not just an ironic knockoff. It's not just there are no inverted commas around this. They really mean it. And this one's produced by Paul Epworth, and I think it has brought in a huge injection of pop, as you're saying, John. It's like, it is a bit psychedelic first, but that's all to the good. I mean, there's a great track called Press Enter to Exit, which is like a kind of hip hop version of John's Children. You know, it's like beautiful and it's spacious and it's dreamy, and none of it is kind of ingratiating. And I've never had a goth phase in my life, and I found this totally persuasive.
I think there's a real problem in that Faris is a good front man, but I don't think his voice is very strong, so it has to be drowned in all the effects. Mm. The lyrics aren't great, so he has spent, I think.
You know, the rest of the previous part of his career just essentially looking like a Joey Ramone kind of looky-likey, which he does really well. I think there's a real ridiculousness about this. But again, as with Mother, I think there's not a problem with it. You know, they were in an edition of Q recently, and it was on location in Barcelona, and all these kind of like black, thin, leather-clad people hanging out on the kind of Las Ramblas in the sunshine and stuff. You think you can't not be aware of your own ridiculousness situation.
You can't directly compare Mother and the Horrors album, but I'm going to make this comparison.
I think you can.
Oh, you're about to.
And I'm going to. The Horrors album is a genuinely pleasurable, uplifting, expanding.
Let it go, Andrew. You can't let this go.
It's a horrible 2 hours.
Which cinema are you protesting outside this afternoon?
View Finchley Road.
I'm going to lock myself to the door of the Dalston Rio and say none shall pass. I mean, I really like this record because there's loads of pop in it, basically.
Yeah.
But I think also that it is very much in theme with the Horrors' heritage. They are a record collection band. They really, really know their stuff down to the absolute deepest roots of all this thing. They're basically a Joe Meek band. And if Joe Meek was still around, these are the records Joe Meek would be making. Sonic Exploration.
He did a really interesting side project, Faris Bedwan, which I think is more interesting than the Horrors, called Cat's Eyes. That was really interesting, and it's goth 60s girl group stuff. Yeah. It's a duo, and I thought the songs were better. I thought the arrangement's better. He works with a soprano called Rachel Zafira. And that's far more interesting to me than Five Skinny White Boys.
What was it called again?
It's called Cat's Eyes.
Yeah. Cat's Eyes.
Yeah,
okay.
That's really interesting. The music's better.
And and you've got that kind of, with that whole kind of Lee Hazlewood, Nancy Sinatra thing going
very
on
dark,
with a kind of real monotone. Yeah.
But it was like they had fun with it, of trying to get into places where they weren't meant to be.
I did think that this was fun. I've kind of not really been impressed by the Horrors up to now, but actually listening to this, I thought his voice is actually much better.
Mm.
And Alexis Petridis was pointing out on social media who's swapped Faris's voice for someone who can actually sing, because he's actually changed quite a lot.
Yeah.
I don't care whether they can sing or not. I think I hate people who can sing. I hate really good singing. It ruins pop. Adele. Horrible.
No, but he can
I'd
now
carry to Wayne Coyne.
He can now hold a tune in a bucket.
Who cares about that?
Before.
I don't care about that at all. This is my favourite Horrors album. I'm throwing my arms around Faris. Let's move on.
Where do you come up to on Faris?
knee high on Paris. Let's have a bit more music. Ali Catterall, what is your choice of tune for this week?
Well, the last time I was on here, I chose my beloved Eno, and I figure it's been a gap of enough to choose him again.
More Eno.
So last month they re-released or remastered his first handful of solo albums, So this is my excuse for having him on again. It's the title track from Here Come the Warm Jets, which I listened to the other night on a record player very low around a friend's house and heard that beautiful kind of red-orangey wash of sound that I so love.
So this is Brian Eno with Here Come the Warm Jets. Brian Eno with Here Come the Warm Jets, as chosen by Ali Catterall. And you were just remarking how much that sounded like mid-period suede there, the entire sort of the wellspring of mid-period suede. OK, finally, we're going to talk about Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams, the new adaptation on Channel 4 of the great science fiction author's short stories. Dick is possibly best known for creating the basis of Blade Runner, his 1968 novel Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? But he should be better known as the navigator of the science fiction unconscious, one of the key figures to take science fiction out of the Zapgun universe of pointless space opera and use it to examine psychology, philosophy, totalitarianism and paranoia. In a typical Dick tale, a criminal will turn out to be a future version of the detective that's hunting him, or Earth will turn out to be a gigantic lunatic asylum, or this very podcast will turn out to be an alien mind infection and you're not real. Can you squeeze all this stuff onto a TV screen? Electric Dreams has quality talent. It's co-produced by Bryan Cranston and Ronald D. Moore of Battlestar Galactica fame, and it features stars as diverse as Anna Paquin, Benedict Wong and Janelle Monáe. We're going to talk about it after this for no reason other than it's great. Here are Giorgio Moroder and Philip Oakey with Together in Electric Dreams. Together in Electric Dreams by Giorgio Moroder and Philip Oakey, which does not appear anywhere near Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams on Channel 4. Ali Catterall, you're a massive fan of Dick. What did you make of this?
I do love Dick. I can't deny it.
To get that out of the way. What did you make of the adaptations on Channel 4?
Right, well, first of all, I'm going to get rid of the enormous hologrammatic elephant in the room in the shape of Black Mirror. Okay. These are superficial comparisons as far as I'm concerned. Black Mirror deals with these kind of on-point morality parables and tales about dangers of technology. This is a way more woozy, meditative, kind of near-impressionistic take on sci-fi. I really liked it. As with anthologies, you know, the quality is going to vary. You're going to like some stories more than others. I did like the first opening episode, The Hoodmaker. The other, you know, stories after that, yeah, like them even more.
Okay, let's talk about that first episode, The Hoodmaker. This is kind of paradigmatic Philip K. Dick, isn't it? It's a cop with a telepathic partner in a very Blade Runner-y world. Firstly, how faithful is this to the short story? Do we know?
Yeah, it's pretty faithful. Mm. Yeah, I mean, obviously there's little riffs on it and spins. I mean, these stories have been freely adapted by the writers. But yeah, basically these stories are very true to the kind of essence of the stories. They haven't mucked about with that at all. Yeah.
Can I ask a question? Because I watched the first one, really enjoyed it. I'm not a Philip K. Dick fan. I'm not a particularly written sci-fi fan. Are the stories set in gloomy future worlds where it's constantly pissing down? or is that something that has just been taken from kind of Blade Runner and is now future Philip K. Dick
pretty much,
world?
Yeah.
Plus, it's obviously a lot easier to do in terms of effects and kind of gloom. But I think
that was my problem, certainly with the first episode and to a lesser extent with the second one. The look of Blade Runner was not created by Philip K. Dick. That's a Ridley Scott creation. It's now been retrofitted as if this is the look of Philip K. Dick's world. And it wasn't. The third episode, which goes out, I think, it's a week on Sunday after you hear this podcast, is set in the real world. It's set in Woking. And it features Timothy Spall. And for my money, it is the best one because it's not trying to create. It's not doing any world building. It's dropping a very strange stone into the pool and watching the ripples. I found the first episode okay, the second one really bad, partly because the world building is just insufficient.
I've only watched the first, but I thought it was, again, you know, it's that kind of suspension of disbelief. And once, as long as it's not only kind of like seven people in the whole world, which there isn't, and that I thought it was quite a good. I thought I didn't mind the kind of world building in it. I thought it looked great.
Sean, what did you make of the ones you saw?
I saw the first one, and I saw the third one, which you're talking about, which is set in Woking with Timothy Spall. And I thought the first one is the semiotics of dystopian future, isn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, seen it. It gets really cliched. There's a horrible scene towards the end. Sorry, program makers, where they get the reveal, where, oh, so you've been doing the blah blah. Yes, I have, because I felt that all the telepathy, and they just go clunk, 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 clunk. That's the plot. We've just explained the plot in three lines through dialogue. Really bad. So some bits I thought were very, very poor. But then, as I say, there's this sort of glimmer of a normal world, and yet there's some schism within it, to which me, Timothy Spall finds, and that was far more interesting, and there was far more of a play, because it wasn't just the cliched iconography of this is what the future is.
To me, the Timothy Spall episode, The Commuter, that's going to go out in a week's time, that's much more faithful to the Philip K. Dick I know,
right,
because it's
right,
the real world given a strange twist. And, yes, you know, he was, a pulp short story writer.
Also, the other thing with the casting of Spall, and with deep respect to Spall and people like Steve Buscemi, who later appear, is that the adaptations of Philip K. Dick's movies we've seen before all feature these kind of dazzlingly handsome kind of beefcake types, like from Schwarzenegger to Harrison Ford to Tom Cruise, whatever. The thing is about Philip K. Dick men is that most of them are kind of schlubs. Most of them are kind of ordinary Joes. They're Joe Schmoes.
So it's losers in space, isn't it? It's losers in space and time. It's the guy at the bottom of the pile. Something deeply strange happens to him, or he finds a way out.
Which is
somehow.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Well, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is incredibly Philip Dick.
Yeah, so there's a template. I mean, the template is quite strong. Yeah,
I thought that both the actors, the main actors in the first one, were really good. I thought that Holiday Granger was
fantastic,
was brilliant.
The other thing about Dick is that, particularly from a writer writing in the 50s, is that he writes really strong and good women as well. Yeah. I think that's incredibly progressive, a man who, as I said, is writing in the 50s in a decade which even did a lot more to sort of accentuate and exaggerate that kind of gender divide. So I know, you know, hats off to Philip K. Dick for that as well.
Yeah, what I really like about is writing at that level is that he writes a kind of bourgeois domestic future, and it's the 50s in the future. It's kind of guys come home from work and settle down with the electronically printed paper, smoke their digital computer cigarettes. It's kind of, it's the world of Don Draper in the future. More often than not, it's actually the world of the guy who works for Don Draper. What I've, of these three episodes, as I mentioned, the Hoodmaker, which is about telepathy, I found it disappointing because I thought it was basically just a pound shot Blade Runner. It didn't bring anything new.
I thought
screen.
There were more interesting themes that weren't picked up. The fact that if she put the hood on, the voices stopped for her. That was really important. That wasn't nothing happened with that. Well, and I thought that was far more interesting than what everyone else was doing.
I also thought trying to drag an hour out of what was a pretty slim story. You know, these were written as short stories, and I felt there was nowhere near enough going on. The second episode, The Impossible Planet, in which, the premise, this is not a spoiler, the premise is a very rich, very old, 300-year-old woman charters a spaceship to go back and see planet Earth again. I thought it was actually shockingly bad. I thought particularly ruined by art direction that was straight from the 90s. I mean, it looked like a free CD-ROM with a magazine in 1997.
I thought it was very moving, actually, but that's probably because I've been cat-sitting for too long.
I thought, the twist on that one you could see coming from a mile off. This was, and again, I thought that would not pass muster in a short story in a comic. But the contrast between that and the, I thought, enormously moving, enormously clever, The Commuter with Timothy Spall makes me want to keep watching this series, because I'm hoping there's going to be more of The Commuter.
I want to see the Steve Buscemi, there Julia is. Davis.
To be honest, I think they made a mistake with opening with Hoodmaker. I mean, I think if they opened with The Commuter, that would have been far better.
But then, if you open with The Commuter, you're setting your stall out as a low-key kind of Tales of the Unexpected Twilight
That's
Zone.
Possibly just the danger with featurettes, is that, as I say, the quality is going to be variable. You're going to wrap up twists so quickly. Mm. But the advantage of that, the positive stuff of that, is that you do boil down things to their essences. You can tell a great story in 50 minutes.
Well, the lining up of those three stories reminded me of, weirdly enough, was when Doctor Who came back in 2005. You open up with a story that essentially sets your stall out, and then quickly you get yourself into space to show the people, the people that we can go to space, but it's not particularly successful because you're just cramming the screen with aliens and robots. And then the series actually starts to get really good. It starts to develop, it starts to become story-based and character-based. And sorry to harp on about Timothy Spall, but he carries that episode because he's
fantastic.
About character. He makes that episode happen.
But he's very, very good. And I don't know if many people could pull it off the way that he does.
But they do have Steve Buscemi lined up for later.
Well,
I think they've got some.
That.
Yeah, so that's what makes me optimistic about a show which I think is a little bit disappointing on its first couple of episodes. Anyway, we are coming to the end of the show, which means it's time for closing time chatter, where our guests tell us what's been obsessing them and driving them up the wall this week. Sian, I believe you've got issues with fame.
Well, it's one of my strange ideas again. Fame, you're not going to live forever. Yeah, I think that fame should either be, in the future, nationalised, so there's some sort of standard, acceptable standard of fame, and then people overreach that, they can go and seek help. Or even banned, if it gets too bad, because it doesn't seem to help anybody. It only seems to sell products, doesn't it? It only sells Nike and stuff
like that.
You
know what this is? This is an immensely Philip K. Dick idea, treating fame as a mental illness.
Well, this is my point, is that people who already tend towards a mental illness and some sort of delusion seem to want the fame even more. Robin Williams, I'm not talking about you. Those sorts of people attract it, and it's not good for anybody. It's not good for the people buying whatever product this person is trying to sell. It's not good for the person. I've never met anyone super, super famous who, you know, seemed to be good on it. Yeah. All those things, it's just this myth. It's just this, the glass, the smoke and mirrors of it. And are increasing, especially, you know, when all the famous people die, like last year. It's like there's only going to be more and more famous people, and we're only going to have more and more of these sad things happen to us as we feel we know the person who's just carked it. It's not right. It is a mass mental illness, I think.
Well, if you were Camille Paglia knocking out your sort of 25-year sequel to Sexual Persona, you would say that, you know, this is actually, you know, you're filling in the final aspect there, the final bit of the kind of cyclical Twilight of the Gods, you know, birth, amazing life story, death, and then it all begins again thing.
Right.
Which, so I quite like the idea of nationalising fame.
I think nationalising it.
Do you want to be Minister of Fame?
I think I need to be in a really high position on this. Yeah.
So you'd be choosing them?
Yeah, I'd be choosing them. I'd be doing the forms. I'd be doing a lot of admin, but I'd enjoy that.
Fantastic. Yeah. We're going to nationalise fame. Excellent. Ali, what have you got for us?
I mean, this isn't so much any kind of argument, but it's just, I just simply want to register my incredulity and disgust at Sean Spicer at the Emmys.
Yes.
Which appears to have been facilitated by Stephen Colbert, of all people. And it's just the whole process of normalising and enabling this kind of crap.
Just remind the listeners what happened then.
So, at the Emmys the other day, Sean Spicer made an uncredited sudden cameo, which shocked quite a few people in the audience, not least Melissa McCarthy, who looked as if she'd just seen a ghost, a sort of headless, dripping one. While Sean Spicer said, we're now here at, what did he say? He made a joke about the size of the inauguration crowd, the lie he told about the size of Trump's inauguration crowd, in which he said, this will be the largest audience to witness an Emmy, period. You know, and everyone sort of hooted with laughter, or let's say 50% of the audience hooted with laughter, the others quite rightly just showed their derision. I just think it's disgusting. I think, what world are we in where, you know, it must be amazing to be without shame, as if it were some sort of expendable organ, you know, like a kidney. You know, I mean, he and Boris Johnson should basically write a self-help book, I think, called Sociopathy for Beginners.
So
that's just me having a rant about Sean Spicer at the Emmys.
Really. It was quite stomach-turning to see James Corden hugging and, you know, kissing him on the cheek. I mean, this is not just an amusing guy from years ago. This is not, hey, look, it's David Hasselhoff. Isn't that funny? The idea that anything is permissible if you're on TV. And I don't think it reflects badly on Spicer, because what could? He already has an appalling reputation. Mm. You couldn't think any lower of him. It reflects horribly badly on the Hollywood, liberal showbiz elite, who've shown how very easily they are bought off simply by somebody turning up and gripping and grinning. Matt, what have you got?
So W1A started its third series this week, the satire on the kind of internal workings of the BBC, which anyone who's worked at the BBC, and I'd hesitate to say anybody who's worked at a large kind of media organisation, yelps with painful laughter every time that they see something they recognise. The storyline this week concerned a former footballer who'd come out as a cross-dresser and claimed that because of his transvesticism he wasn't getting slots on Match of the Day. And so the team, Hugh Bonneville and his team, arranged for him to kind of essentially have a live tryout on Match of the Day to see, and he was completely terrible, and it was all very funny. The next day, the BBC announced that Giles Corran was going to be the presenter of the new BBC Two
show. A guy who doesn't go to the theatre because it doesn't fit his baby's bath time.
That's correct.
Yes. And he doesn't have any records, apparently. He
doesn't like music either, apparently.
And the parallels between the satire of putting somebody really crap onto and totally unsuitable onto a TV show just to show that he couldn't do it. I kind of, you know, amazingly, it seemed to ring very, very
true. But Giles Corran is enormously popular, Matt, with everybody. I know, great guy, hell of a guy. Okay, well, my closing time, Giles, is a very, very simple one. Rolling Stone magazine is up for sale. Ooh. Jan Wenner is going to sell Rolling Stone. This should be the twilight of magazines. If this is up for sale, if this is over, it's all over. And I was surprised how little I cared, actually. You would imagine that this would be an absolute shocker, like the Times closing down or BBC One going off air. It just feels like something entirely of the past. And I'm realised I was, I'm so sick of hearing Rolling Stone associated with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Baby Boomers. The Baby Boomers have brought nothing but misery on us. The Baby Boomers the Baby Boomers have voted for Brexit, voted for Donald Trump, kept their dreadful music shoved down our throats ever since they've, you know, they've kept the control of power since God knows when. And if this is a sign that maybe it's ending, then that's a good thing. So we're going to buy Rolling Stone, Matt.
Do you get a hold of the archive? Because I would love to get, I mean, apart from anything else, all the Ralph Steadman cartoons, all the Hunter S. Thompson stuff.
That's true. Yeah.
That'd be, you know.
Yeah.
Well, let's buy it then.
Yeah, okay.
Can I come in on that?
Yeah, okay.
Good, thanks.
You got a fiver?
I've got £7.50.
We're going to crowdfund it. Send your donations via PayPal and Big Mouth will buy Rolling Stone. Okay, so there we go. That's another show in the bag. Thanks to Sean Patton and Ali Catterall for coming in. Please come in again. You're welcome. And listeners, do remember, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com/Big Mouth. You can subscribe in the podcast section via Apple Podcasts, as well as finding us on Spotify. And you can follow us on Twitter at @big_mouth UK. We're going to see you again next week. You've been listening to Big Mouth. Or have you?